practicing those things that we study and putting in our everyday walk, because that's what James reminds us in this book. If we've got a lot of visitors with us today, so I'll just quickly backtrack so you kind of know what we're doing. Sounds like Joshua and I are going to be in lockstep. He's going to do a quick overview of Ephesians. And if I thought what we were going to tackle was going to be fast, sounds like he's going to do one even faster, so I like that. We have decided to look at a high level, letters to the Christians, letters to the early Christians. And so we were in James, and I started with a couple books that we thought were written early. And really what we're trying to identify is who wrote the books, why'd they write them, and really an overview of what the books were about, or the letters were about. And so as we go through this, I'm not saying that we won't stop and that we won't take time to look at individual things, and we might get granular on some things, but this is really a good test for us from a knowledge standpoint. I guess in school we would call this maybe a pop quiz, and that is, what do you remember about the book, and what stands out to you? Because I may or may not point it out, you may be thinking something else that's really important. So I want to make sure we hit on all of those things. So we talked about the James that we believe had written the letter here, the book of James. We talked about the time of the writing, which we thought was one of the earlier books. And we also talked about we're getting into why we thought the book was written at a high level. And so with that, we've covered chapter one. The goal is we were going to try to cover one letter every 2 weeks. We'd intro the letter, cover it, and then move on. So we'll have to move to see if we'll be ready for Galatians. We had left off in the close of chapter 1, and we were just talking about verses 12 through 15, understanding temptation and why and how we can endure a temptation, why we have temptations that crop up in life, and then how we can get through those. And we talked about the man who endures temptation will be blessed, and how will they be blessed? We said with the crown of life, as they're proven. And we said, what did the Lord promise those who will endure, and those who do what? Those who love Him. So temptations, who do they come from? And I guess maybe more importantly, who do they not come from? God does not tempt us. And so we know that God can't tempt us, but He does allow tests, and we know that can happen. And so anyone who is tested or tempted is drawn away by their own desires. James talks about this here, drawn away by their own desires and enticed. And we know that when desire is conceived, it gives birth to what? Sin. And so as it gives birth to sin and it's full grown, what does full grown sin bring about?
Death.
Okay. So that's basically where we left off. We were going to talk about, I think I kicked it off. Yes.
So how was Job's experience with temptation?
How was Job's?
What took place to him in temptation?
That's a good question. Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit last week where Job, a good perfect example, we read that God, it says God tempted Job.
Sure.
What's happening there?
Yeah.
What's happening is God
allows it
to happen. And therefore takes credit for him, but it wasn't God doing it.
Yeah.
It was Satan doing it.
Yeah. Yep. But for sure he was being tempted and tested. Yeah. But it was allowed. Okay, good. With awareness of the Father's goodness, we do not want to be deceived. And every good and perfect gift we know comes from above. James points this out, and again, we're kind of in verses 16 through 18 here, and we know that comes down from the Father of lights. I've used the word true a lot, and I think we can consistently see where there is a reference to true religion, true faith, and I guess you would say consistency is a word that I was thinking about. But true religion consists of doing and not just hearing. And we know that that's an important part. Anyone can hear the word, and it's the actual doing that's the tricky part, right? So we should be swift for sure to hear the word, but let everyone be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to what else? Wrath and anger. For the wrath of man does not produce righteousness. And I think that's an important point here for us, is that we have to be careful not to allow our anger to be aroused. It's easy to be done, and it's probably one of the greater tests for all of us. So this piece about not being hearers only but doers, what should we lay aside, and if we do, what will we receive? What are the things that we should lay aside? I think this is a point where we can slow down a little bit. Does anybody remember in this chapter what we're supposed to lay aside? Okay, all right. And I don't know, maybe you're out of a different version, but filthiness, wickedness. You lay aside all of these things. And when you think about filthiness or wickedness, the list that we could write would be huge, wouldn't it? I mean, there's a massive list of things that could be laid aside that encompasses all of this filthiness. And I think that you said receive meekness, or did your Bible maybe use a different word? We know eternal life, but...
Mine says save your soul.
Okay, save your soul, okay. Well, we'll receive meekness and implanted word, which is ultimately able to do what you said, save your soul. Right. Yeah. We can look at that. But yeah, so all of those things that would beset us, we would... it is in chapter 12. Yeah, I was going to say, so... Yeah. I'm not seeing, but I know it's there. Okay. Yeah, since also surrounded so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us or besets us, and we'll run with endurance. So any of those things that are going to, and I don't know if you had a comment that you were going to make, but those are all items that you set aside, put out of your life.
And I think with each individual, we all have, when it talks about this, there we're talking about that we are drawn away with our own lust. I think every individual has certain things that are more...
you're more susceptible.
And so each of us have to work very hard on those things to overcome.
Yep.
Through prayer.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and we know that's that process of putting off that old person or old man and growing in the new person, new man. And, you know, I think this is a good point that you make. It's easy for us to look at maybe a sin that easily besets you and think, what's their problem? Why do they struggle with this? That just seems so weird. Why would, and I'll throw one out there, why would alcohol be a problem? I've never had a problem with alcohol. We all have our own individual things that might be an issue for us, and we know that through prayer and supplication we can get through those, but we need to help each other through those, because what besets Eric is not going to maybe beset me, and what besets Ben is not going to beset Dwayne. We're just made different, and we all have issues, right? Okay, any other comments about that?
Not enough to put off, but we must put on.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yep. And in putting on that, I'm putting on Christ. That's a process, isn't it? Yeah. Yep. Good. Good point. Yeah. And I should have said this up front. This is a classroom setting, so collective. So please make comments at any time. You can cut me off. So then that brings us to this being doers of the word and not just hearers only. So when we're hearers only, what does he remind us that we do? If we say that we're hearers only, what happens? Yeah, we're deceivers. And who are we deceiving typically? Ourself, right? No one really worse to deceive than yourself, because, you know, that's a slippery slope. If we start deceiving ourself, We kind of talked about that in our last class. If you can deceive yourself, then you have this feeling of I'm okay, and you're going to continue in whatever it is that you've got a problem with. And the example that was used, anybody remember the example in this deceiving of ourselves? What are we likened to?
Look into a mirror and you say, well, I guess I'm okay.
Yeah.
You go away. And you
say, sure.
You forget about it.
Yeah.
Even though you look in the mirror and you see that you're not kept like you should, but then you just go off and forget it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, can you imagine if you got a big dirt smear on your face and the whole reason you went to look is to see what you had. You have food on your face and you... Yeah.
Call it out of sight, out of mind.
Correct.
The human spirit does that real well. Let's just don't think about it and we're okay.
Yeah. Well, we use the word justification, or we justify what we're doing at the time. And we're professional at it. We're very good.
But in John, 1 John 3:18, it says, my little children, let us not love in word or tongue, but in deed and in truth. So we can't just talk about it.
Yeah. Yep, so I shored that up by saying we have to obey the word and put it into action. You know, yep, I think the action, yeah.
This passage is making an assumption, I believe, that we even know what the word says.
Okay, good point.
Because I've encountered, been aware of different things where there's such an ignorance of even what God expects. So this passage is making a conclusion that you even know what the Lord wants, what God wants, but you have some idea. Because if you can't be a hearer only, if you don't know what you know, what's expected of you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, good. Any other comments? Okay, and then there's a reference to looking into the perfect law of liberty, which kind of is your point, but... what happens? Well, we can't be forgetful here. We've got to be doers of the word, and we'll be blessed in what we do. And if you live, to Theda's point, live by the law, it will save you. And that seems a little weird, especially for some people to think about that, because there's so many people that don't want to abide or, even abide in the law, or they want to break the law. Well, we know, but by living in this law, it will save you. And how does that happen? How does living in the law or recognizing the law save us exactly? What is it that is about that will bring about salvation?
Obedience.
Okay, right. Your obedience. We see our sin. We see where we're wrong. And why is that important for a Christian? Well, you've got to make corrections. You've got to, if we're going to do what he's asking us to do and you're going to abide in that law, you've got to first and foremost know when you've deceived yourself or you have broken that law or you're sinning. Okay. And then we get into pure and undefiled religion before God. And what's it say there? It kind of closes by saying, visit the orphans and widows and their trouble. And again, it's examples about action items. Doing something, not just hearing. Okay. Any other comments about chapter 1 before we get into chapter 2? How do you do the last part of that?
How do I do that in today's world?
Now, I was going to say the word visit there. What does the word visit mean? Does it just mean go stop by and see?
No. I don't believe so. And how I'll answer it with a question. How is it that we truly can't help, to your point? You know, there's a lot that can be done, that should be done, but visiting, and visiting might be one of them, but that's not where it stops. I think that's your point. There's a lot that can be done.
Yeah. Look after.
Okay, exactly. So you look after someone, what are you really doing? You're tending to their cares.
You know what they need.
Correct. You know what they need, which is going to take some doing, and then physically the action part comes in. So, you know, any of us can know what somebody needs. I may know what Luana needs, but if I don't do anything about it, what's the point? Yeah, Mark, were you going to make another point, or is that...
Well, in today's world, we have so many organizations that are addressing this. I think in the time of this writing, you know, this was an obvious thing. There was a widow over here that didn't have
sure.
children. She didn't have anybody to provide for.
Yeah.
And so some of the institutions that we've established in the parish takes care for them.
Right.
But it didn't, especially for the widows, it does not take 100% care.
Right.
I know some who've taken this passage and taken the fact of the fatherless as those without parents and adopted them, which to me is taking the ultimate step as far as caring for them.
Right.
Maybe that works, but then, yeah, I think if we get involved in some of these organizations that we think are right and maybe help them out financially, that would be a way of us taking
I think there's a lot. Like you say, this is broader than these two groups being listed right here. And I think some people want to look at just those two groups. There's a lot. You know, in the secular world, in the schools, we talk about kids that are homeless. Well, the way you and I think of homeless is you physically, literally don't have a place to go sleep. You have no home. There are so many ways that's defined nowadays. You're living with grandparents. You're maybe living in a camper. And there's seven different things. If you've been in the school system, you know what those are. And it's our job as a school to kind of think about how we help those kids. Back to kind of Mark's point. This is a broad thing. There's a lot of people that can be helped. Yeah, Ben.
So one thought on this particular passage is that it's possible that these are two examples that are given as a general rule of what is expected.
Yeah.
So you know, is it only taking care of widows and orphans? That's what makes someone, you know, have a pure and
unspotted from now.
So what are those representing? Well, it's possible that what's being represented here is do good to those people who have no means by which to repent.
Yeah.
And we can look at several other passages that talk about that same thing.
Yep.
So there's the one thing. Do good to people and don't expect them to do good back to you, right? And then the second thing is to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Live a life that is sin-free.
Yeah.
And so you do those things and it's pure and undefiled religion.
Yep.
David said in Psalms 146:9, he said, "Oh, the Lord watches over the strangers. He relieves the fatherless and widow." Well, who does he have to do that here on earth? But his children.
Us, yeah.
That's
right.
It's up to us to help. That's he may help in other ways, but I mean in the physical ways.
Yeah.
Actually getting out and doing and helping.
Yeah.
We're the only ones.
Yep, that's right. Okay, good point, good discussion. Any other comments about chapter 1?
I think it's mainly about heart. You need to have compassion.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot to that. We could spend a day on those two verses or that last passage. Okay, chapter 2. Chapter 2, I told you I would intro kind of a chapter, what I thought from an overview we would look at. But chapter 2 shows us the sin and danger of showing personal favoritism. So there's a little bit about favoritism there. This chapter points out the folly of faith without works. And so that's kind of a good segue from what we've just talked about and how faith without works is dead. So we'll see that. James introduces, in my opinion, three principles of faith. Commitment is the first thing that we're going to kind of read through and see. You're going to see right actions. That's the word I plucked out of there, but right actions. And those are basically a byproduct of your faith. And then faith without good deeds really isn't good for anyone. It's not good for you. It's not good for those around you. So, true religion does not show partiality. How were they showing preference here in this letter? What was pointed out? Who were they showing preference to, first off?
In the assembly of the saints.
Yeah, but who are they?
Assemble, they say, well, the richer folks get a better seat, a more prominent place is kind of it's all kind of phony stuff.
Yeah. Well, we could see this happening. You know, my front row here, these are my close friends, they're wealthy. I've got, you know, the Collies and the Rogers that sit up here, and I'll show preference to them, and so they get the best seat. I mean, that's what we were talking last night. We went to the PBR and we looked down and we saw the seats that were $200 plus seats, and we dabbed our blood from our nose because we were up high. But that's how it works, right? You pay more, you get better seats. You know, whatever. So this preferential thing, it's been happening forever. But what, you know, there's danger in that. So what's the reasons to not show partiality, especially to the rich? And there's like six reasons that come out here, and I'm just going to name them. It makes one judge with evil thoughts. We'll talk about that. Has not God chosen the poor to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom? There's a question maybe for us. Have not the rich oppressed and blasphemed you? It gets them to think about that. Do not the royal law call upon us to love our neighbor? There's another question he asks. Partiality will convict us as transgressors, even if we stumble in only one point. And we shall be judged by the law of liberty, in which judgment without mercy is given to those who show no mercy. Those are all points that are made there in verses 4 through 13 on reasons why. And he's asking, I guess you'd call semi-rhetorical questions there, asking them questions to get them thinking. Why is it not good to show partiality? And all those things are listed. Comments about those things? I know that's a high level overview without getting into details of those 14 verses, but any comments or thoughts about any of that?
The bottom line is, if you show partiality, you are sinning.
That's right. That's right. There will be judgment. No mercy for that. Okay.
I think there's another point.
Sure. Yeah.
Just don't judge me. Let me do whatever I want. Don't judge me.
And that's the very thing you're doing when you show partiality.
And yes, but what I think here is it's a difference between recognizing there's two qualities, life standards in this presence. You're going to see it. Someone walks in with a lot of gold necklaces and stuff. You're going to see it. And you're going to recognize there's a lot of wealth with that.
Yeah.
And you're going to recognize someone who comes in with some bivalves that are worn, tattered, patches on it. It's one thing to recognize it and acknowledge it in your mind. It's when you what you act upon it. And that's where I think he's getting into.
Yeah. The actual showing of partiality. Showing.
So to make this, to say, well, this person looks like he has wealth and this person doesn't have any wealth, that is judgment, and it might be accurate. But it's what you do with that information is what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Interesting. So why is it that people gravitate towards wealth or power, just like if the president comes to town and it's a closed meeting and there's people fighting tooth and nail to get in?
Yeah.
Some are. Some
or
are.
even on the roads just to line it. Yeah.
So why is it that people want to identify with famous people or rich people? Isn't it because we want a little part of that? We want to know what that's like? Isn't that the urge maybe to do that? Maybe we'll get the
possibly, system? Yeah. I think for sure the possibility is there. But yeah, I mean, look at it. There was a reminder here for them, so you know it was happening. But today, it's like you say, whether it's a musician or a president or whoever.
You need to realize, what that's all about and what reality really is.
Prestige.
Yeah, yeah, be around the prestigious. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. We
all want to feel important, and it'd be just great to tell somebody that, man, I was standing right next to the president.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at this autographed picture of me shaking hands
with
the president.
Yeah, yeah.
People fight for this.
Yeah, that's right.
I've seen it happen.
Yeah, it's true. Kind of interesting when you think about it.
That impose their will upon you. And you say, well, I want to stand with the president. Oh, by the way, he's going to tax me another 50%.
Right, right. He's going to oppress you. Why are you...
Why are you calling him who this man is? He's making your life miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he goes out of his way to make the point. Yep. They blaspheme you and they oppress you, but you want to be with them? What, you want to make a big... You want to show partiality? You want to give them the best? Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, and then faith without works will not save us. What profit is there in faith without works? Can such faith save one? Is there any profit to tell a naked and destitute person to be warm and filled? So I kind of jotted down a note here. If you go to someone who truly is in need, this goes back to kind of what we were talking about just before, and you say, well, be warm and be filled, but then you don't do anything for them, what good is that? I mean, we can sit here and talk about it all day long, you know. Boy, you look really hungry. I'm sure you're hungry. I hope, go be filled. And you don't, and there's no action. There's no feeding or no taking care of. Then that works piece is not there. And so faith by itself without works is dead. And it's just it's a really important message for us. But it's probably an easier said than done thing. We have many who have needs, whether it's in this local congregation or outside or even another country. And do we talk about it? Do we put a letter up on the bulletin board but don't do anything about it? Or do we make an announcement and then we don't go and help the person? And so it's just a good reminder for us. It's not enough to just claim that you have faith. Anybody can do that. And what does he liken it to, just to remind who else had faith? Even the devil and the demons believe in God. So think about that. If that doesn't get your attention, he was trying to get theirs. Even the devil and the demons, they believe in God. And they tremble. But what's the difference? Well, they know. They have an understanding, a knowledge, but they're not going to do anything about it. So our works is demonstrated when we love and we want to do something about that.
We ought to keep in mind what Jesus said to Judas Iscariot when he said we could take this money and fed the poor.
Yeah.
The poor will always be with us.
They're always going to be there.
Always going to be there. And I think this, making reference to here, here's an opportunity that was presented to you. What'd you do with it?
Yeah.
So it's not a case that this person necessarily went out seeking for someone. It was presented to him. So what'd you do?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. What was the Old Testament example used here about faith and works? Who was used? Okay, Rahab was one. Who's Abraham? And, you know, Abraham exemplified this. You know, he was called the friend of God. He was justified by works when he did what? He offered his son up on the altar. And his faith was working in his works. And then it was perfected in true faith. That's how it was perfected. By his works, the scripture was fulfilled, and it declared him faithful and righteous.
This is always my struggle in putting together. I guess it's not necessarily a struggle, but it's always a very good study for me, is comparing Romans and James. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Romans, the book, is primarily about righteousness through faith. And James very clearly here talks about you've got to have faith, but if you don't follow that up with works, it's of no good.
Yeah.
If you think about Romans 4, it says that God accounted to Abraham righteousness through faith.
Faith.
Because God came to Abraham before he was a Jew, before he was circumcised, mm-hmm. and made the covenant, made the promise with him. Before.
Yeah.
He accounted to him because of faith. And so this is a good balance, I think, James is to the book of Romans
when yeah.
it comes to faith.
Good. Great point.
Belief and faith. You can believe, but not have works.
Yeah.
But you can't have faith.
Correct.
So,
you can, but it's, yeah. Well.
You can't have faith. You won't be faith. It would be belief.
Right.
If you fall back to the belief, I think. Because if you have faith, you're going to work.
Yeah, that's the tree that bears fruit. If you don't bear fruit,
then it's,
that's
yeah.
the evidence that you're not in the vine, that you're not, you don't have true faith.
And there's people who believe in God, but they don't have the works to show.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the two that you may not know what somebody's desires are. But if you can see their sins, then you probably know their desires. The
right.
same thing about faith is
shows you
may not know if somebody has faith or not, but if they're producing the right works, most likely they've got the faith.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was John Morris that said, if I'm standing down here below and say, jump, and you won't jump off the roof, then you've told me a lot about your faith and my ability to catch you. Yeah.
Thank you. Also, he's using Abraham here. He also, if you look in Hebrews 11, which we all call the faith chapter, but he uses by faith.
Sure.
And then he follows it up by works. I don't think it's an accident he
Yeah.
And they're using the person they look up to.
Sure.
And they're saying, Abraham's, what he did was accomplished by faith, and you need to do the same.
Yeah, correct. Good point. Okay, and then Theda, you had mentioned Rahab. So, you know, that's an interesting, here we have the harlot, and pretty unlikely example to be used here, but definitely got used, and she was justified by her works when she did what? What was it she did? Yeah, hid the spies, and, you know, so.
There's an interesting twist in that story, too. She lied to help the spies.
Yeah. How that all plays in.
Worms that we, I don't know if we want to open that up or not. I'm not sure I have an answer for that, but where she was a harlot also, but obviously what she did was to
protect and
protect herself, but also showing your faith.
Yep.
This God is going to do exactly.
Right. Yeah, it was faith, and her works showed. Okay, that shores up chapter 2. Chapter 3 was the appreciation of the power and danger of the tongue, and to understand the difference between heavenly wisdom and which is earthly, sensual, and maybe I guess you'd say demonic wisdom. True religion controls the tongue. And the power of the tongue is likened to what two things? Anybody remember? I think Mike mentioned one the other day. What's that? Okay, a little rudder and what else? A bit. Okay. And the dangers of the tongue is, there was a few talked about here, but it's a little member which boasts great things. You know, for something that's so small, it can do such great damage. And like a little fire which kindles a great forest fire. So these are examples it used. Indeed, the tongue can be a fire and a world of iniquity. It's capable of defiling the entire body. And when you think about that, that's pretty amazing that this little thing, which I think maybe Mike mentioned the other day, when we're really talking about the tongue, what are we talking about? What controls the tongue? Our mind. And so, but, you know, it's capable of setting on fire the course of nature and ultimately can beset us and set us on fire and send us to hell. What's the difficulty of taming the tongue? Well, it's controlling our mind. It's what goes in. What's the one of the things I list is probably the worst thing we can do is what? With our tongue, what's one of the worst things we can do? Okay. Yeah, so it's bless God and curse mankind. I knew what you were saying, but basically, which will obviously be worse to curse God. But, yeah. But it's really that reminder, though, of the tongue can be so good and yet so bad. And when you think about it playing both roles, that's the danger of it. So, man can control creatures on the land and sea, it says, but not the tongue. And it's unruly evil. It's full of deadly poison. These are all reminders listed there. But with it, we can bless God and curse man. And that's a problem. So, you know, we get this picture of blessings and cursings coming from the same spot. And that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be the case. And so, what are two ways he reminds us that that really should not happen? What are two examples? You remember the two things he writes about there? Yeah, fresh water and salt water shouldn't happen. And then, what was the other one? There you go. Eric just kind of brought that up. But a fig tree can't bear olives, and a grapevine, you know, bear figs. And so, really tries to give them a visual, which again, he's very good at these visualizations of using something so simple that they would understand to say, hey, this should not be the case. You should not have your tongue, your mind, have the ability. It has the ability, but it shouldn't be so. You shouldn't have cursings of mankind and putting people down, saying and doing the wrong things, and yet then trying to bless God with that tongue.
Another reminder of a quote this week from Abraham Lincoln when he was giving speeches, running for the presidency, and one of the things that he said in one of his campaign speech was a quote from the Bible, which many of the presidents did at that time,
yeah.
It was, a house divided against itself cannot stand, and speaking of the issue of slavery.
Yeah.
Same thing here is, you've got to choose a side.
Yeah. Yep. Good.
No man can tame the tongue. We shouldn't stop there. We should understand that it can be tamed. We of ourselves cannot be able to and cannot tame it. But if we know the word of God, let God be in our obedience and in our tongue talking, then the tongue can be tamed. But we can't. It's just like anything else. We can't do it ourselves.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I meant to ask that question. That is, does that mean we just can't tame it? And we know that through God, that's possible. It's going to be difficult. Go ahead, Mike.
You couldn't tame it with God's help.
Right.
How could you be righteous?
That's right.
How could you be holy?
Correct. Okay.
I was sitting here thinking about this verse and thinking, well, how did the Pharisees fit in with this here? With it, we bless our God and Father. Well,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, they intended to bless their God and Father, but then when they made up their own their interpretations.
Yeah, what were they?
More important than, than the law itself, and in a sense, they were cursing mankind for things that really they shouldn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Or you didn't wash your hands right,
Sure. Yeah, it's all these little. Yeah. Yep. All right, let's just close this out then. And so then 13 through 18, the true religion displays, I guess you'd say, heavenly wisdom. How can we truly display wisdom and understanding? Well, it's been mentioned throughout this whole deal. Through our conduct and with works done with meekness. He makes that point. Works done in meekness. And, it's totally different when there's a display of earthly wisdom versus heavenly, right? Display of earthly wisdom is described there in verses 14 through 16, full of bitter and envy, and they're self-seeking, they're boastful, and they're lying. A wisdom not from above, but is earthly, it's sensual, it's dynamic, producing confusion and evil things. And so we have those points made there. And then the display of heavenly wisdom is totally different. Wisdom from above, it's first pure, and then it's peaceable, it's gentle, it's willing to yield, it's full of mercy and good fruits, and it's without partiality and without hypocrisy. If you were going to be wise, and you just look at those two lists right there, what do you want to be wise in? In the books of today, and you want to be some brilliant scholar, or do you want to have heavenly wisdom? It's a no-brainer.
So, Clayton, I got a question for you.
Okay.
In verse 18, it says, these things are the fruit of righteousness. What's the difference between the fruit of righteousness
and the fruits of the Spirit?
Fruit of the Spirit?
Okay. Eric's question, it might be a good one to... We're 1 minute over with. Anyway, but what's the difference between the fruits of righteousness and fruits of the Spirit? Maybe we'll... go ahead, Dwayne, you got a quick thought. Okay. Other quick thoughts to close, and maybe we can pick that up.
Why do we want wisdom in the first place?
It depends. It depends on if you're talking about heavenly wisdom or you're talking about earthly. There's a lot of reasons why people want earthly wisdom. Why is it that we should, as Christians, want heavenly wisdom?
Well, I think some of it is a physical desire as well, Mark, that Adam and Eve had. They desired wisdom to be wise by God.
Yeah.
I think that probably still resides in each of us, is that we want to be closer to God, we want to be with Him, for our gain or for His gain.
Okay. We will, a couple good questions in class there. We'll pick up just there at the very, very end of that chapter. We're going to, we'll start in chapter 4 and quickly close the chapter or the book out and then get into Galatians next week. So if you want to read ahead, that's where you can read. Thank you.